23.
Dear Lord Almighty,
Boone shouts as he stumbles back, nearly catapulting himself down the mountainside. My father would normally chide someone for using the Lord's name in vain, but Boone's words sound more like he's honestly beseeching God for help. That alone says a lot. Boone's a hard man. He shot Chafin in the head without so much as a, how do you do? But this has him rattled. And he's not alone. I've seen my fair share of horrors and taken more than a few lives in my time, but I've never encountered something like this. Arthur hasn't just been killed, or even simply dismembered. He's been put on display. The top half of his body is impaled on a sturdy tree branch that's been cleaned of twigs and leaves. I step around his body, which is dangling 10 feet over the ground, trying to figure out how he was placed there. Behind him, I see that the branch forks, both prongs punched into his back, keeping him upright, even as the branch bounces in the wind. His arms flop loose. His jaw hangs open. The skin around his eyes sags.
What are you thinking? My father asks.
I'm surprised that he's brought Owen back to the scene, but when I look for the boy, I find him 20 feet downhill, his back turned. Seated beside him is Enola, her hands clasped behind her, slowly shaking her head. His body is still in a state of primary flaccidity, I tell him, and when I see his confusion, I add, everything is loose, means he died sometime in the last 2 hours, probably in the last hour. I point to the stretched and torn skin hanging from his midsection. Pink droplets of rain-thinned blood drip from his body. Beneath him, the ground is stained dark red. I point to the blood-soaked earth. They put him up there pretty quickly after killing him, and they did it recently. The more I whittle down the timetable, the more tense I become. I've got the rifle ready to go, but still aimed at the ground, my finger resting beside the trigger.
How can you be sure?
The rain, I say, putting my hand out to watch the torrential downpour splash off my skin. In a few minutes, the blood will be washed away, means he only recently stopped bleeding out, means this happened in the past few minutes. My father snugs the shotgun against his shoulder, eyeing the forest, our home turned nightmare.
And it just happened to be in our path. Maybe it's a coincidence?
You don't believe in coincidences, I tell him.
No,
he says, looking into my eyes.
I don't, and we can talk about that later.
He's figured out who I am, of that I have no doubt. But unlike Owen, he's not ready to completely accept me as his grown son. And I don't blame him. I'm not sure what kind of man he wanted me to become. We never got a chance to have that conversation. There's a chance I've fallen short of his hopes and expectations. He's seen the violence of which I'm capable, seen the boy by his side grown up, bringing pain into the world. He wants better for Owen, I realize. And now that I've met my younger self, so do I. But for that to happen, my father must live. Screw history and the potential paradoxes. Owen needs a father. I needed a father, and now we both have a chance to get that back. Boone, I say, waving the man over. He creeps up the hill, ducking away from the half-corpse. Would your men do this?
Heavens, no.
He wrings his hands together.
We ain't opposed to taking a life here or there on occasion, but this man wasn't just killed.
He glances up at Arthur and shirks away.
He was mutilated, desecrated.
I find it odd that Boone feels that desecrating a dead body after the soul has left it is somehow worse than the act of killing. But he's also right, to a point. Being impaled on the branch, displayed for all to see, is a desecration. Being torn in half, I'm pretty sure that's just how he was killed. I don't see any stab wounds or cuts of any kind. He was just yanked in half. The horses, I say, speaking to myself but loud enough for my father and Boone to hear.
What horses? Boone asks.
The man you shot. He and his men rode in on horses. A good number of them are loose on the mountain. If someone rounded two of them up, they could have done this. It's a primitive way to kill people, using horses to tear someone in half. But it sends a clear, stay the fuck away kind of message.
But why?
Boone asks. Wouldn't we all like to know? I say.
I'd really rather not, my father adds, given the choice.
He looks a little ill, keeping his eyes turned away from Arthur's body. What does it say about me that I can both look at him and take my time examining his wounds?
It's revolting, but whatever part of me that should want to run from this has been dulled. Just another way I'm not the man my father probably hoped I'd become. It's a scare tactic, I say, forcing confidence. Arthur was alone, exhausted, and unarmed. This wasn't done out of strength, it's an act of weakness. Two or three men with horses, probably terrified by what's happening. I run through a mental list of possible suspects, but don't come up with anything that makes sense. Minuteman didn't strike me as the sadistic type, and I doubt he'd hire people prone to atrocities. Boone's men are the most likely culprits, but if he is the hardest of that lot, I doubt any of them would have the stomach for something like this. That means there's someone else on this mountain, but from which time? We need to press on, I tell them. The answers we need are at the peak, and the longer we wait, the harder it's going to get. Enola, who's been strangely silent, helps Owen to his feet and stands between him and the body as she leads him uphill past the grisly scene. The rain doesn't let up as we continue our course uphill. I take the lead with a rifle, Owen behind me and my father behind him. Boone follows in the rear, muttering to himself, occasionally asking for a weapon that he's not going to get from me. I don't trust him. He might be with us now, but the moment a better situation comes along, he'll throw us to the wolves. Speaking of wolves, we're far enough back in time now that they're back on the list of predators we need to watch for. They're big cats, bears, wolves, and the worst of them, people. For a while, Enola stays close to my father, but then she strikes out to the side, weaving back and forth in front of us. Hatchet in hand, low to the ground, she stalks up the mountainside, looking for signs of danger. She's done this before, I realize. She's moved through these woods, wary of the danger her fellow man presents. If there is any sign of danger on our way up the mountain, she's not going to miss it. Her zigzag path requires her to hike further and faster, but she doesn't seem fazed by the workout. In her time, there's no such things as couch potatoes, microwave dinners, or automobiles. She's accustomed to being on her feet, and her stamina reflects that lifestyle. Even I couldn't keep up with her. Our progress is slow but steady. Synergy is just an hour's hike. I try to decide what to do first. Check in with my crew, get my family someplace safe, or kick down the laboratory doors and demand answers. But I decide to play it by ear. I have no idea what I'll find. The facility could be in ruins. The scientists could be dead. Minuteman and his people might have already taken control. I doubt there is a plan I could come up with that I won't have to abort the moment we arrive. So I focus on the here and now. Staying alive and reaching the peak are my current mission objectives. I'd like to say the forest is quiet, but the hissing rain drowns out everything, even the squelch of my wet footsteps. Visibility is crap. The only way I know we're headed in the right direction is the constant upward slope. And it only gets worse when a thick fog settles in, as it's prone to do in the Appalachians. Enola slips in and out of existence, a silent ghost moving through the fog and rain. Her presence is both comforting and surreal. When I see her, part of my brain sees a woman in costume, acting silly, but the rest of me knows that she is real, that all of this is real. I'm back in time with my father, myself, a bootlegger, and an American Indian, trudging up a dell through lands guarded by the mutilated corpse of a man from the 1920s. It's almost enough to make me laugh. Then I hear a bird call. While there are plenty of birds on the mountain, they've fallen mostly silent in the rain and thunder. What I heard was the call of something large, something different. I tense for a moment, aiming my rifle toward the sound, until my father places his hand on the barrel and eases it down. Then he raises his hands to his mouth and performs his own bird call. The reply comes immediately, and this time with a sense of urgency. It's Enola. She's found something. Hang back a bit, I tell my father and Boone, creeping toward the sound. They keep a 20-foot distance between us as we move toward Enola. Any further, and we might lose each other in the fog. Enola, I whisper. Here, comes the reply. She's just ahead on the far side of a broad tree. When I see blood on the bark, I raise an open hand to the others, motioning for them to stop. Then I ease myself around the tree. Enola is crouched, her back to me. She glances over her shoulder. I think I found the rest of Arthur, what's left of him.
Steeling myself for the worst, I step around her and find myself totally unprepared. My stomach sours, and I turn away. After taking a moment to collect myself, managing to not retch, I return to the scene, better prepared, but sure I will have nightmares of this moment. Arthur's lower half is here. His organs are strewn about, tangled in the mess of entrails. But that's not the worst of it. His legs have been separated, his pants torn away, and the flesh eaten, down to the bone, raw. Again, I nearly vomit, but I manage to switch off my emotions and turn on my analytical mind, as I did when we encountered Arthur's upper half. There is still meat on one thigh and on one calf. Preserved within that flesh are long gouges, teeth marks, large teeth marks. Arthur was eaten by an animal, and given the bite radius, I'd guess it wasn't the mountain lion, a pack of wolves, or even a bear. Whatever it was, I don't want to stick around to find out. "Let's go," I say to Enola, "and do not tell the boy." She nods, eyes wide with fear that she's doing a decent job of hiding, and we return to the others. "What was it?" my father asks, squeezing Owen to his side. I think we jumped a bit further back in time.
"How far back?"
Owen asks. "To when predators were big enough to tear a man in two and peel the meat from his legs in a few bites, I think. But I say, a lot further."